4. It's got that sinister look he has at the beginning of the story. But what I like about the Grinch, as I've mentioned before, is that it's not really a negative story when you think of the whole story. The Grinch story is our story because he repented and changed. And that's what this whole story of ours is about, our relationship with God. We were all walking around with a heart that was two sizes too small. And Christ found us. The Holy Spirit indwelt us, and we said yes to Him. And so I want to bring us to a story today that is, we began a series last week called My Dysfunctional Family, and I hope there's something in that phrase even that connects with all of us, because the family has been desperately under attack in our culture for a long while now, and it's being shredded into little bits and pieces so that it no longer exists in some places, and you can take or leave a family if you wish. And yet, the family is God's basic foundation stone for humanity. And so, we're coming to Genesis chapter 38, and I would ask that you would get a Bible, find one, and turn there just now. And if you need to go to a different pew to grab one, do that. Genesis is the first book in the Bible, so just start at the beginning and page through till you find chapter 38. Now, we read a story last week in which the second youngest son of in a family with 12 sons was deeply hated by his older brothers and resented by his older brothers because of some family dynamics that had been going on for more than one generation. And they sold him off into slavery. His name is Joseph. He's a famous guy. You know his story, no doubt, even if you just watch Hollywood movies. He's been in plenty of those. Part of the point of this series is that Joseph is just one of the characters in what God is doing in this last half of Genesis. God used Joseph to save Jacob's family. Jacob is an important guy because he's the grandson of Abraham. Abraham was given a promise by God, and the promise was Isaac, his son, who was born to him when he was 100 years old and his wife was 90 years old. And then Isaac had twin sons, Jacob and Esau, and Esau was born first, but Jacob inherited. In fact, Jacob made sure he inherited by deceiving his elderly father, who was blind, into thinking that he was the other son. And so he has lived with the consequences of this. And now Jacob is an old man. He has 12 sons and one daughter. And his youngest son has been taken off into Egypt, into slavery. And Jacob is mourning his loss very deeply because he loved Joseph, because he was the son of his old age. And the wife who bore him was his favorite of his two wives and then two concubines. So that is the background. And now we come to a story, the story of Judah and Tamar. And this is a tough story. This is probably one of the least taught stories in the Bible because it's a difficult story, but I think it's a critically important story. It's a pivot point. We saw in the whole business of the brothers selling Joseph off into slavery, we saw Reuben, the oldest, step up and say, well, let's not kill him, let's throw him in this cistern. And he was thinking to take him back to his dad. But Reuben was in touch with his dad already, he was in trouble. And so he wanted to do it for that reason. But Judah stood up and said, let's not kill this boy, it's not right to take his blood. And he did it more from the moral principle that you ought not to kill anyone, especially your brother. And so selling him off into Egypt was better than killing him. So that's kind of where Judah has gotten to in his moral development in the story. So now, chapter 38 takes us to Judah's life, and all that happens in chapter 38 is the same thing that's happening in Joseph's life down in Egypt. So the same amount of time goes by, so that when we get to the end of this chapter, Judah is going to be at the place where the Joseph story is when his brothers come to meet him in Egypt long later. So God is working on Judah because he's the one that God is trying to call up and to be the leader of this clan from which the kings will come, King David will come, and then finally the Messiah Jesus will come. And so Judah is processing the dysfunction of his family. It just drives him crazy that it's this way, and so he actually just walks out of the family, which was really unheard of in that day and very difficult to do in that day, and it was only possible because they were, in fact, a wealthy family. There were no such things as banks in those days, but they had a lot of sheep, herds, and animals, and so they were wealthy in the coin of the day. And so I would say that if you think the last chapter was a dysfunctional family, wait till you see what Judah does by way of starting his own family. So let's start at verse 1, and I'll kind of talk us through, we'll learn as we go here. It starts out with the phrase, at that time, which is sort of giving us that parallel thing. So at that time, so Joseph's just been sold into slavery, and in American entertainment world, this would be the phrase, meanwhile, back at the ranch, and that's how it starts. At that time, Judah left his brothers. It's a little too crazy with you guys wanting to kill Joseph. What's up with that? And he went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. And here Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua, and he married her. Now, this is a point out. Take note, Judah is acting on his own behalf. He gets his own wife here, and she is a daughter of the people of the land there. He married her, and I'm going to be more literal than the NIV here, and he went into her, and he conceived, and she conceived and gave birth to a son whose name was Er. And now she conceived again and gave birth to a son and named him Onan. And she gave birth to still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Kezib that she gave birth to him. Now, Jacob got a wife, verse 6 says, for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. Now, a couple of things to notice here that Judah has done this twice. He got two wives. He got one for himself, and then years later, he got one for his son. So a lot of time has transpired here, long enough for this son to grow up and to take a wife for himself. Now, this is a tribal world. Let me remind you, women in tribal situations to this day in Africa and places like that, girls are married off as soon as they're able to have a baby, and usually boys get married not much longer later than that as well. And so it's very possible the generations build up very quickly, and a young girl could get married at 13 or 14, have a baby, and her baby have a baby 13 or 14 years later, so she could be a grandmother before she's 30 years old. That was the world that they lived in. That was how you survived and how you kept your line going, and that was just the world they live in. This text, the story is hard for us as modern people to understand. In fact, tribal peoples who hear the gospel and these stories are shared with them, they immediately gravitate to these stories because they understand it. This is how their life still works. And so what's mentioned here is that Judah's wife is a Canaanite. But it's not mentioned about Tamar. And so it's probably a good assumption that Tamar was a girl from Jacob's tribe, from Judah and Jacob's own people. And so this becomes a factor here. In those days, and in most tribal situations, it's the father's responsibility to find a wife for his sons and to find husbands for his daughters. Jacob has not gotten Judah a wife. I don't know if it's because he didn't want one or what, but he has decided to act like an American and do this for himself, which was complicated in that world. And so in this world, again, there was no welfare, there were no social agencies, there were no policemen. You did what you thought best or what you could get away with, as the case may be. And if you didn't have a family, especially if you were a woman who didn't have a family, your life expectancy wasn't very long. You were either going to be dead or extremely poor, or you were going to be living in prostitution to survive. So everybody needed to be inside the realm of the family in order to survive. But Judah, again, was well off, and so he moved away from his family. I don't think he cut himself off from them, but he found his own wife. And the problem with the fact that he married a Canaanite woman wasn't an ethnic thing or a racial thing, because they themselves were just people from what is now Iraq. But it was about their worldview. You see, Abraham was a worshiper of God Almighty, El Shaddai, Yahweh. And that demanded different things than to worship the idols. To worship the idols all around you, to worship the rocks and the trees and the streams, was an entirely different worldview. It was more than just a religious problem. It wasn't because God was petty or jealous or cranky. And we're going to see this play out in this story, the problem with intermingling worldviews here. And that's why even to this day we talk about when you engage, when you start a business with someone, when you get married to someone, you want to engage those things with someone who has a like, not just worldview, but who is a fellow follower of Jesus. And it's a very important thing, and it's always been a very important thing. So the worldview problem was that you were afraid of all the wrong things. You were afraid to cross the stream because the god of the stream might get angry at you. And then on the other hand, you weren't afraid of things you should be terrified of. You should be terrified of Yahweh, the God of heaven and earth, because he is your creator. You should have respect and fear for him, you see. And so that's why there was a collision of worldview. So the years are passing. Judah's firstborn son, Er, has a wife named Tamar. And in verse 7, but Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in God's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Wow. That seems harsh. Now, this name, Er, I don't know, is the word Ra turned backwards, and Ra means wicked and evil. It's a little bit of a play on words. And it wasn't because his mother was a Canaanite, but you'll see that that perhaps was a contributing factor to what was happening in Judah's family. Verse 8, then Judah said to Onan, his other son, now here's where it gets strange for us, very strange for us. Sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to raise up offspring for your brother. Now that was a common tribal practice of the day. Now this gets, this was about surviving again. This is so that the name of the person who had died could remain on the earth, and it was a family obligation. And it was also to give the widow status and stature within the family. So later on in the law of Moses, and remember, the person who's writing this for us knows the law of Moses. It's ostensibly Moses himself. And so he has received the law. And what you find as you read the laws is that they are not theoretical or imaginary things. What they are is their boundaries to set around the behavior that's already going on. The revenge cycles, the honor killings, things like that that we still know about in human behavior today were very much problems. And so the law of Moses sets out to address those things. And so sometimes the law will talk about something that it doesn't especially espouse, but it's trying to regulate it. So we get an example of this in the Gospels when they come to Jesus and they ask, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? Well, so Jesus interpreted for them what was going on. He said, in the beginning, it was not this way. In the book of Genesis, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. That was God's intention. And then he said, but Moses permitted you divorce because of the wickedness of your hearts. So that's the purpose of the law. So in the case of divorce, what Moses said was, when you or if you divorce your wife, because he knew people were getting divorced, at least give her a certificate of divorce. Tell everybody what you did, okay? Write it down so that she can have her place back in the community. Someone else can marry her without fear that they're marrying your wife that you threw out. You see? And so the law is about holding in God's people into a place so they won't be like the culture around them. And so that this practice seems outrageous to us, that if two brothers are alive and one has a wife and that brother dies, that this brother should father a child by this woman. In fact, later on in the law, a man was not allowed to marry his dead wife's brother unless she had no sons. She needed that son. So for Tamar, once she got a son, she would have status and power in her world. She would have a place, and there would be no question about it. So again, we think of marriage as something, romance. It was mostly about how to survive, and it remains that way today in those cultures. So let's press on. And this gets crazier and crazier, but we'll see how this works out. Verse 9, but Onan knew that the child, in other words, he was going to be married to Tamar, his brother's wife, his dead brother's wife. He knew that the child would not be his because, you see, this child was being fathered for the specific purpose of carrying on his brother's estate in his brother's name. So he knew that he was going to lose money on this deal, in other words. So whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he spilled his seed on the ground to keep from providing seed for his brother. And that's the scripture writers telling us exactly what he was doing wrong was what he was doing to his brother's inheritance, as it were. So what he did was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. Tamar was being abused in this situation. It was wrong, and God was angry with this young man who would not fulfill his obligation to his family on one hand, but was willing to have sex with his sister-in-law. And that was virtually a capital offense in the law later on, you see. So this is a strange world. I will grant that. But this was how they maintained their societal structure. The law accommodated it, but the law tried to move God's people away from this system as well. And so Judah has now lost both of his sons. That's his perspective. I had two sons, they're both dead, and the last person that saw both of them alive was their wife, Tamar. This girl is bad news. I mean, that's his perspective. She might just be, you know, 17 years old, for heaven's sake, you know? So try and imagine this. And so Judah says in verse 11, he said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, live as a widow in your father's household until my son Shelah grows up, third son. And for he thought, he may die too, just like his brothers. So he was getting her away. He was sending her back to her father's house because he didn't want to pay for her food and lodging. And he wanted to get her away from his sons because this girl is bad luck. And so Tamar went to live in her father's household. It was his responsibility to provide for her. So what is Judah not doing? Or what is he doing? He is doing whatever he thinks he wants to do. He's just reacting to the situation. And what he's not doing is seeking the Lord. Oh, what a novel idea. It never comes up. He never does this. The Lord is in this text. And the Lord is just acting in judgment. That's, you know, Judah, if you're going to do this, watch this. And so the Lord took these two sons away from him.